Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Austin Peterson here. Today is Monday, July the 7th. I hope you all had a great Independence Day holiday. I know I sure did. And I want to talk today about something that I think is really important in the liberty movement. It's something that we very rarely talk about. Because it's something that I think we are so opposed to in so many ways. The art of war, ladies and gentlemen, or I like to call it the art of fighting because I don't like war, but I think war and fighting are the kinds of things that you have to prepare for, despite the fact that you always want to try and find a way to avoid it. Now, the state is obviously not looking for any chance to avoid war because pulling from the many resources that I'm going to be pulling from this morning, I was looking at Sun Tzu and the art of war, and funny enough, the very first maxim from Sun Tzu is the art of war is of vital importance to the state. And that is absolutely true. You may have heard the term war is the health of the state, and that's also true because the state thrives on war. It grows on war. It builds its power on war. And today, I think that we need to talk about this important subject because although so many libertarians are peacemakers, it is very important that we learn how the war works, how to fight, because think of it from a self-defense perspective. You need to know how to defend yourself if you ever have a home invader, for example. Or if there ever was a war, then there does come a time when you have to defend yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm going to be analyzing the military strategy of certain generals, namely Sun Tzu. I'm also going to be looking at the strategy of George Washington, our first president. And I'm going to be looking at the tactical strategy of certain martial artists, namely Bruce Lee and also myself. I'm a martial artist as well. And we're going to be talking about the tactical strategy of fighting and a little bit about the art of war. Now, there, obviously, Sun Tzu has hundreds of precepts that you'd have to cover, so I won't be able to get through all of them. But I've written down some of the best ones that I think we can all learn a lesson from. And I'm going to start today with some of the practical aspects of fighting that I want to talk about because I think, it's very important that we understand these so that you want to learn how to fight so that you can learn how to not fight. Because one of the things that I've learned as a martial artist, which I've been doing Japanese karate for about a decade now, one of the things that I've learned is that once you learn how to fight and you've taken a punch, you don't want to get into a fight. People who have been in real fights will tell you, fighting is dangerous. I mean, you can lose a tooth. I mean, a black eye is probably the easiest you can get off of the fight. You can have a broken limb. But fighting is always dangerous, and it's something that should be avoided. And that's why if you ever seen the Bruce Lee movie Enter the Dragon, the very first scene of the movie involves this philosophy, Bruce Lee's philosophy, and he calls it the art of fighting without fighting. And this is something that I apply in my daily life. It's the kind of thing when you have a problem with someone in your life, someone that is trying to goad you on, trying to egg you. Maybe you've got a bully. Like in the opening scene of Enter the Dragon, Bruce Lee was being bullied by this bigger guy on a boat. And so in order to beat his bully, the guy says, "Hey, let's fight." And Bruce Lee says, "Okay, you want to fight? Let's go. I'll tell you what. Let's go fight out on this island. We'll take a boat. We'll take this little paddle boat and we'll go out to the island and we'll fight." And so this big bully says, "Okay, yeah, we're gonna go out on this island and fight." So Bruce Lee is like, "All right, here you go." So he hands him the rope to go get on the little paddle boat to get off the bigger boat. And while when the bigger guy, the bully, goes to get on the smaller boat, Bruce Lee pushes him out to sea and holds him out there by a rope. And that's called the art of fighting without fighting, because Bruce Lee outsmarted his opponent, you see? Because a smart person who knows the consequences of fighting will understand that the best way to win a fight is to not fight. If you've ever seen the movie martial arts classic Karate Kid, there's a famous line where Mr. Miyagi sort of echoes this philosophy where he says, "Best defense, no be there." And that was the crane, Karate Kid Part 2, where Daniel LaRusso is learning how to avoid getting hit by the crane. And so Mr. Miyagi teaches him that the best way to defend yourself is not to meet an opponent head on, but to not be there. Because there's so much that can be lost in a simple fight, and most fights are not worth it. There were times when in New York, for example, I could feel myself being hassled by bullies. And yeah, you know, I knew martial arts. I probably could have turned around and kicked these guys' butts, these guys who were on the street harassing me. But what would have been the point? You know, just for a simple, you know, somebody dissing me, just somebody insulting me. There are a lot of times when it makes sense to fight. But for the most part, fighting doesn't make any sense, ladies and gentlemen, because all it's going to result in is a big, expensive medical bill. So you have to learn, when you learn how to fight, you want to learn how to pick your battles. Which battles are actually worth fighting? This is the kind of thing that the Tea Partiers need to learn. Because how many candidates have Tea Partiers supported all across the country, and they were battles that weren't worth fighting? Probably the best example would have been the fight against Senator Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. That's a good practical example. That was an absolute waste of time and resources. First of all, I don't want to even get into this, but the fact is that Senator Mitch McConnell, compared to all the other Republicans that they could have taken out, like Lindsey Graham, for example, he had one of the highest conservative record scores from Heritage Foundation and from FreedomWorks. So here we have now all these resources that were poured into fighting Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, and meanwhile, Lindsey Graham won his primary, and we had very good candidates going against Senator Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. So the art of knowing how to pick your battles is one of the most important lessons that you can learn in the art of fighting, in the art of war. And let's talk about the strategy that I think Bruce Lee used the most in his fighting. He called it the philosophy of water. So when you actually do have to fight, he said that you should be like water. And again, this applies not only to actual fighting, like fist fighting or war, but it also applies to political strategy as well, if you're trying to beat an opponent. Bruce Lee says you should be like water. And that what does that mean? So if you had a clay pot, for example, and you fill it with water, the water changes its shape to fit the pot, right? So whatever opponent that you have to combat, you have to change your strategy in order to beat that opponent, right? You shouldn't use the same tactics against every opponent every time. I play this game called Civilization, and it's basically a tactical strategy game where you can play as the United States, you can play as Mexico, or you can play as, you know, different countries or cultures. And basically, each culture has their own strengths and weaknesses. And so you sort of have to change your strategy based on the opponent that you're facing off. And if you use the same kind of strategy over and over again, people who play Risk know this, if you use the same strategy, you're probably going to lose because every opponent is different. So Bruce Lee said, you have to be like water. You have to change your strategies according to the opponent that you're going to face. Now, I'd like to move on from Bruce Lee here to one of my own stories that I think is important when we're talking about changing your strategies. Because when I was in New York City, I was studying at the Shotojuku Dojo in Astoria, Queens for a number of years. And you know what I learned? I learned a couple of things, well, quite a bit actually, but a couple of the most important lessons that I learned was, one, that there are just some kind of people in this world, ladies and gentlemen, that like to hurt other people. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, there are, like, I know you think bullies, the idea of like the bullies strings comes to mind, but I'm talking about people who actually sadistically enjoy hurting other people. Now, being in martial arts, I've come into contact with many of these people firsthand, you know, in the dojo. But, you know, a lot of these people, sometimes you don't see them out in the real world that much, but that's just because the type of sadistic people who, when they operate out in the real world, these type of people, they tend to operate sort of secretly, or they can be a boss, for example, that gives you extra work when it's 5 p.m. You know the type that I'm talking about. These are people who enjoy seeing other people suffer. I think that's probably par for the course for a lot of our elected officials. But you, doing martial arts, you'll see that there are people who are attracted to the martial arts because they want to hurt other people. And usually those people tend to not last very long in the martial arts, just because there's always a bigger bully, you know, when you're out there. So a lot of times these guys will come in and then they'll get knocked out. But every once in a while, there's a few of the real sadist a-holes who will make their way up through the ranks. And I want to tell you about this one bully that I actually defeated. And I did it by being like water. And when I was studying at the dojo one day, we were doing fight training. And this guy was NYPD. He was a police officer. And obviously, he was off duty at the time. He was there training at the dojo. And you know what? You could tell this was one of these guys that just likes to hurt people. And, you know, when you're studying karate, when you're studying martial arts, most of the time you're going to be fighting somebody, or you're going to be training with someone who is not at your skill level. A lot of times, you know, you'll be put in classes, sometimes even with young people and things like that. And, you know, it's kind of like the Kramer episode of Seinfeld where you're fighting with kids, which it can happen. But a lot of times you're not going to be fighting someone who's exactly at your skill level. It does happen. But for the most part, there's going to be a bit of a difference either in weight or height or something that's going to give someone an advantage. Now, when I was a younger martial artist, I wasn't a high belt level, but I was, you know, a large guy. I'm about 6 foot tall right now, and I weigh about 200 pounds. And that's, I've consistently weighed that for about the last decade. So I think this police officer, this NYPD, you know, he was a black belt, and he saw me as a legitimate target, because even though I was you know, sort of a green belt, I was, a young white belt, or I was a really low belt level, he's like, oh, well, he's an older guy and he's got plenty of mass, so I can just pound this guy. And oh my God, ladies and gentlemen, he pounded me so hard all the time. But you know what he did? And this was his fatal flaw, was he repeated his tactics over and over again, because he had this secret kick. You see, he would do this secret kick over and over again. When I say secret kick, it was basically this fake out kick that he would do. And what he would do is he would act like he was going to kick you in the knee, right? He was going to kick your knee out, but then all of a sudden his kick would flash up to your face. So what I did was I studied his moves, and because I saw that he did the same technique over and over again, one day I waited for him, and because I knew he would pound me like he usually would, but this was going to be the day that I was going to finally win this fight. He started to do his secret kick where he was going to block, where he was going to kick my knee, and instead of blocking down, I blocked up, grabbed his leg, and just kicked him as hard as I could right in the stomach. Well, that guy went down like a ton of bricks, ladies and gentlemen. Then he got up, and he could barely breathe, and he started throwing punches at me, and the sensei had to grab him and pull him away, and I was just, like, throwing up defenses like crazy because I thought he was going to kick my butt. But you know what? I won the fight. I won the fight because I was like water. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the famous military generals. I want to talk about the strategy instituted by George Washington, because this is the kind of thing, and I'm going to relate this over to Saul Alinsky and Rules for Radicals here in just a few minutes. I want to talk to you about a strategy that George Washington used. He didn't pioneer it, but it's something that George Washington used. Remember, strategy in war is philosophy. You know, it's not necessarily just, you know, guns and troops and fists and bows and arrows and things like that. It is philosophy. It's the philosophy of war. So that's why so much of this has been perfected, you know, hundreds and even thousands of years ago, because the same philosophical strategies will always apply, because humans always sort of respond to the same type of tactics. And George Washington knew this when he was fighting the British. And socialists, modern socialists today, use this strategy to take over the government. And it's one that libertarians conservatives, freedom fighters, people who believe in limited government need to know, they need to understand, and they need to mimic these philosophical tactics and strategies. This strategy is called Fabian strategy. And I'm reading this from Wikipedia, forgive me. The Fabian strategy is a military strategy where pitched battles and frontal assaults are avoided in favor of wearing down an opponent through a war of attrition and indirection. While avoiding decisive battles, the side employing this strategy harasses its enemy through skirmishes to cause attrition, disrupt supply, and affect morale. Employment of this strategy implies that the side adopting this strategy believes time is on its side. But it also may be adopted when no feasible alternative strategy can be devised. Now, think about this. This is what George Washington did in the American Revolution. He knew that he couldn't win large-scale pitched battles. So he did a lot. He had the militia going out, harassing skirmishes, creating skirmishes, disrupted their supply lines, and did everything he could to try and affect the morale of the troops. Now, who else used this? Think about this. Vietnamese. The Vietnamese in the Vietnam War used a Fabian strategy. They could not fight the Americans face-to-face in the type of war that we had fought like we did in World War II, where we fought the Germans and, you know, it was sort of a civilized form of warfare compared to what was going on in Vietnam. So what the Vietnamese did was they got in close to the enemy. They would come in close to the Americans because they knew that the American airstrikes would not be able to affect them if they were close in to the American front lines. They adopted a Fabian strategy. Creating traps and laying out traps in the field. They knew that all they had to do was survive because it was their land, and so all they had to do was wait us out. Wait us out, and then that's how they could beat us. And Fabian strategy has been employed for thousands of years. I think it was named after the dictator of the Roman Republic who was fighting Hannibal in southern Italy. The guy's name was Quintus Fabius Maximus Verrocasus. He was the dictator of the Roman Republic, and he used the Fabian strategy against Hannibal to achieve victory at the Battle of Trebia and the Battle of Lake Trasimene. After that, he was declared the dictator of Rome. So can you think of any other examples of people who use Fabian strategy? And if you actually go to the Wikipedia page, there's a section there on Fabian socialism. And it says right there that the ideology of the Fabian Society, which originated in 1884 and launched the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, it utilizes the same strategy in their war of attrition in their aim to bring about a socialist state. It's the advocation of gradualism, which distinguished this brand of socialism from those who condone revolutionary action. So think about this. There are two kinds of socialists, right? There are the radical communists, the Marxists, who are trying to have a revolution and try and overthrow the proletariat and the bourgeois. They're trying to use the proletariat to overthrow the bourgeois. But the gradualists, the Fabian socialists, those are the ones that have been successful. Remember, how many Marxist revolutions have there been that have been successful? There have been a few, but not many. It's the Fabian strategy that has allowed socialism to take root in so many countries, including the United States. It's the gradualists, the people who are willing to fight a war of attrition and know that it will take years, but that time is on their side. Well, libertarians have to learn these strategies too. And I'm going to talk to you about a Fabian socialist right now. The guy's name is Saul Alinsky, which you may have heard of him if you're really into politics. Saul Alinsky had Rules for Radicals. And in these 12 Rules for Radicals that I'm going to go through, Saul Alinsky laid out the strategy, which is a sort of modern-day rules of war for progressives to use in order to institute their ideas. And it is so important that libertarians listen and understand and read these and internalize these. Because in order for us to win, for us to have libertarian, free market, limited government, classical liberal ideas instituted, we have to adopt these strategies. Now, here they are, the complete list, and I'll try and get through these fairly quickly because then I've got to go through some Sun Tzu, and we're going to talk the Art of War, and I don't want to bore you guys, so I'm going to try and get through these as quickly as possible. Rule number one, this is from Alinsky, power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have. Power is derived from two main sources, money and people. Quote, have-nots must build power from flesh and blood. These are two things of which there is a plentiful supply. Government and corporations always have a difficult time appealing to people and usually do so almost exclusively with economic arguments. So here's the thing. Power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have, right? And how do you get power? It's derived from mostly from two sources, money and people. And since we libertarians are generally have-nots, we have to build power from flesh and blood. And what that means is that we have to build an army of people. The Tea Party did that, and they successfully won landslide elections in 2010. But since then, they have sort of eschewed that, and they've started to fall back, and they've lost power because the numbers aren't there. The crowds aren't there. And it's so important, ladies and gentlemen, in order for democratic action to work, which we do have to take democratic action sometime, unless you're a revolutionary overthrow the government type, I'm talking here about the Fabian strategy. If you believe that democratic action can work, which I think it can, because the socialists have demonstrated that it can, we need numbers, and we have to build our power from numbers. That's what I'm doing here at the Libertarian Republic. That's what this whole project is about here. I'm trying to build the Libertarian Republic, to build an email list, to try and build, you know, a large social network, to build multiple websites, build the libertyviral.com website, which is brand new. I'm building these to build flesh and blood powered numbers, people that I can actually call on when it comes time to do battle for liberty. Because again, like, you know, some people are thinking, oh, well, you know, you're just doing this to make money every single day. No, you don't understand, ladies and gentlemen. I'm doing this because I have a long-term strategy, because in 5 years, in 10 years, the numbers and the resources that I will build from building this network will be something that I can use in order to fight the battles and win for liberty. So let's talk about rule number two. Never go outside the expertise of your people. This is a good one. It results in confusion, fear, and retreat. Feeling secure adds to the backbone of anyone. And organizations who are under attack, and they wonder why radicals don't address the, quote, real issues. This is why. They avoid things which they have no knowledge, right? So, obviously, your opponents are going to say, hey, why aren't you talking about the real issues? Well, that's because these are the things that you care about. But if I have a group of people, let's say I have a meetup group organized for a candidate, I don't want to go outside the expertise of my people and try and give them tasks which they don't have any interest or knowledge in, because we're just going to fail. Don't fight the enemy on his own territory, on his own turf. Make him come to you by fighting battles that you can win with the people, with the strategies that your people know, things that they're already good at. So let's say you have someone who's very good at writing direct mail. Well, you want to focus on direct mail. Or you have someone who's very good at organizing volunteers. You want to have them doing that. Don't go outside the expertise of your people and expect them to do something like, hey, you who are good at direct mail and writing good letters, why don't you build a social network? No, because that person is not going to be confident, and they're probably not going to succeed. Very important rule. Rule number three, whenever possible, go outside the expertise of the enemy. Look for ways to increase insecurity, anxiety, and uncertainty. This happens all the time. Watch how many organizations under attack are blindsided by seemingly irrelevant arguments that they're then forced to address, right? So here's the thing. If you've got an opponent, like Lindsey Graham, for example, and you know he's weak on something, you've got to attack him on what he's weak on. Now, here's the thing. A perfect example of this for Lindsey Graham is that, you know, people call him Lindsey Grahamnesty, right? Now, let's say you're a libertarian opponent of Senator Lindsey Graham running against him in a primary, right? Now, you may be agreeing with Lindsey Graham. You may think, oh, because you're maybe a more open borders type libertarian, or you're more cool with immigration, which, you know, I certainly am. then even if you may agree with Lindsey Graham on that, I'm still going to call him Lindsey Grahamnesty. I'm still going to use the tactics that I know are going to win, because it's going to harm him, because I know that this is something that he is not good on with his base, with the Republican Party. Now, just because I may hold the same opinion as him, I'm not going to tell people that. I'm going to make sure that before I get into office, that I use the strategies that are necessary to win. And that's what you have to do, ladies and gentlemen, because that is what the socialists are doing. You have to fight the battles the way that they're fought. You cannot say, oh, well, my principles are so much more important. Well, your principles are meaningless unless you actually can bring them about to power. Nobody cares about these ivory tower elitists who are writing white papers every single day. And yes, they're right, and they're all alone, and their ideas will never be brought to fruition. It is the activists that will actually bring the ideas to power. So you have to take power before your ideas can ever actually be taken, be implemented into public policy. And that's what this is all about. We're talking about the art of fighting, ladies and gentlemen. So if you're one of those people who are like, I don't want to, like, you know, push my ideas and things like that. No, then get the hell out. Turn off this podcast. Get out of here. I don't have time for you. I don't have time for weakness. This show is about strength, and it's about power, and it's about the will to power. Let's talk about the next rule. Rule number 4, make the enemy live up to its own book of rules. If the rule is that every letter gets a reply, send 30,000 letters. You can kill them with this because no one can possibly obey all their own rules. This is a very serious rule. The besieged entity's very credibility and reputation is at stake, because if activists catch it lying or not living up to its commitments, they can continue to chip away at the damage. So let's say you have a candidate who strikes a pledge, right? Then make sure that you do everything you can to force them to live up to that pledge, right? So if somebody signs Grover Norquist's taxpayer protection pledge, then, and if they break it, if they vote against it, you've got to attack them on that issue. It's those weak points, the chinks in the armor that you have to look for, because when someone makes a promise to do something, you've got to hold them to that promise. And remember, nobody can live up to all their promises. And that's why you got to be, most politicians usually are very careful about what they say. They speak in platitudes. They don't want to make too many promises because they understand Saul Alinsky's rule number 4, that it's impossible to live up to all of your promises. Rule number 5. Ooh, this is my favorite one, ladies and gentlemen, and you're going to know why in a second. Ridicule. Ridicule is man's most potent weapon. There is no defense. It's irrational. It's infuriating. It also works as a key pressure point to force the enemy into concessions. Well, let me just ask you, ladies and gentlemen, something. Do you even liberty, bro? You know what I'm saying? If you know me, you've probably heard me say that, right? Well, what is it? It's ridiculous. It's irrational. It's just simple ridicule, or calling someone an idiot or a fool or stupid or whatever you want to call it. Lindsey Grahamnesty, for example. You have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, if you are recoiling at the idea of using ridicule, this is not the show for you. Get the hell out. You don't have any guts. This is a show about fighting. We are learning how to fight, and if you are not going to ridicule, you're weak. You are such a weak little weenie. I'm avoiding really crude language here because I don't want to lose sponsorship, but I'm telling you, you weak little pieces of crap, get the hell off of my show and don't come back. You're useless to me, all right? Now, are you still here? Good. Then you understand. Ridicule is a potent weapon. It's infuriating, it's aggravating, and it will throw your opponents off guard. It happens to me every day, and you know what I do? I ignore it. You know why? Because I understand what its point is. It's pointless. The point is to throw you off your game. If you are defending against this, the best way to do it is to ignore. Never, ever, ever respond, but use it against your enemies liberally. Number 6, a good tactic is one your people enjoy. They'll keep doing it without urging and come back to do more. They're doing their thing and will suggest even better ones. This is a really good one, actually. When I was working at the Libertarian Party for a year, I had an internship team, and What I would do is find out what people were good at. What did my interns like to do? Some of them were really good at writing op-eds. Some of them were really good at doing phone calls. Some of them were really good at doing social media. And so if you've got a group of people and you are all working together towards a goal, a good leader will find out what everyone's strength is and will utilize it. So that's a really important one. I'll go ahead and move on. I think that's self-explanatory. Number 7, a tactic that drags on too long becomes a drag. Ooh, that was a good one because I actually was reading this one from Sun Tzu this morning, and he was talking about siege tactics if you were sieging a castle, for example, or a fort, and it took too long, then you need to reassess your strategy because a good fight is something that needs to happen fast and get it over with. You know, Hitler used this in World War II. It was called lightning war, and the Nazis would just basically, instead of using the trench warfare attacks in like they did in World War I, where they would just sit there and they would just do these prolonged battles, he used lightning war, blitzkrieg, to crush the enemy, and he would win decisive battles fast, and he would have tanks, you know, panzers rolling across the enemy front lines to take key positions. This is something that you have to use if you're fighting a battle. You know, if you're fighting a fight, for example, let's look at it back in martial arts. You know, the best way to win a fight is to do it fast. Strike first, strike hard, and get the fight over with. Because here's the thing. If you let an enemy start making attacks and continue, if you've committed to battle and you've already said that I have to fight, you know, and you haven't, you know, you've gotten past what my first rule was, the art of fighting without fighting, and you're in a fight, then the thing that you have to do is that you have to strike first, because you already know it's a preemptive strike means preemption for a reason. Now, I know a lot of libertarians are like, oh, preemptive strikes, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's called preemptive for a reason. And there is a moral case for a preemptive strike. And the reason is because preemption comes before something else, meaning that you know someone is going to punch you, someone is going to attack you, right? So you've got to fight this. If you committed to a fight and you know that you're going to get into a fight, don't let the fight drag on. Get it over with immediately. Strike hard. Strike first. No mercy. If someone raises their fist at you, you know that they are going to hit you, right? Don't let it happen. When I was bullied on the playground as a kid, I got beat up a few times. Well, you know what? I learned my lesson. Because then when I saw the bullies coming up, they would sneak up behind me, boom, donkey kick right behind me, boom, right in their stomach. I knew that they were coming. I knew that I was going to be in a fight and I was going to get my butt kicked if I did not preempt them. And if I let the battle go on because I was younger or weaker than these bullies, then I knew I was not going to win because eventually they were going to pin me. So I used lightning war to hit first, hit hard, and end the battle before it could really go on and drag on. Rule number 8, keep the pressure on. Never let up. Keep trying new things to keep the opposition off balance. As the opposition masters one approach, hit them from the flank with something new. Attack, attack, attack. Boy, that is so true, ladies and gentlemen. So many times I see libertarians or conservatives, people who are fighting fights, who are engaged in a campaign. And what'll happen is I'll see people, they'll be like, oh, well, you know, it's 4th of July, it's a holiday, or it's, you know, it's getting late, I might as well go home, and there's all this work left to be done. That is not how you win, ladies and gentlemen. When you are engaged in a battle, there is no rest until you win that fight. That means that all day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you will be fighting that fight, and you do not rest until it is done. So that is a really important one. Let's move on to the next one because I still got Sun Tzu, and I'm afraid we're dragging on here. Number 9, the threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. Imagination and ego can dream up many more consequences than any activist. Perception is reality. Oh, that is so true. Think about it, ladies and gentlemen. If you're big and you're scary and you can make a threat, usually the people's imaginations will be way more imaginative, obviously, than what the actual thing may be. So if you're like, I'm going to punch you in the face, for example. Well, if you say it really scary, you know, then maybe somebody's going to be scared that you're going to break their nose. Well, maybe maybe you have, maybe you're a lightweight. Maybe you punch them in the face and they're going to realize it's not that bad. And then you're going to be in trouble because you're going to have shown your hands there, your cards there. So it's very important that you understand that sometimes a very good threat can actually deter people from getting into battle with you. A good example of that was, you know, when I was on the streets of New York once, I was with my girlfriend at the time, and she was walking beside me, and this guy was kind of coming up and hitting on her, even though I was with her. Well, I turned to him and started threatening him in the most terrifying way that I could while adopting my martial arts stance. And the guy thought to himself, well, you know what? This doesn't look like a guy I want to mess with. And this happens in nature all the time. I mean, how many animals have defense mechanisms where they'll blow up, like, you know, cobras, for example. They have that big hood. The point is to appear bigger than they actually are. Now, cobras do have deadly fangs, but they try not to use them all the time. But it's the threat of the larger possibility of getting involved with this animal that keeps so many other animals from getting involved with it. So again, remember, a threat can be more terrifying than the act itself. Number 10, if you push a negative hard enough, it will push through and become a positive. Violence from the other side can win the public to your side because the public sympathizes with the underdog. Unions do use this tactic. Peaceful, albeit loud, demonstrations during the heyday of unions in the early to mid 20th century incurred management's wrath, often in the form of violence that eventually brought public sympathy to their side. Yeah, there were times when corporations, like the head of the corporations, would actually machine gun protesters. And so that kind of violence was definitely the kind of thing that brought the public over to the union side. And, you know, again, I know, ladies and gentlemen, we don't like violence, but I'm just telling you right now, if you have a Occupy Wall Street protest, or, for example, maybe that's not a good one, a Tea Party, can you imagine? Just think of this. What would have happened if police, like riot police, had started to baton old ladies at Tea Party protests? Can you imagine the public's reaction to something like that? Now, I'm not saying you want to put people in harm's way, but you know what? That actually reminds me. Sheriff Richard Mack, some of you who might be familiar with him, he's a constitutional lawyer out in Nevada, I believe. He was at the Bundy protests when the Bureau of Land Management was threatening Bundy out in Nevada over the cattle seizures. Sheriff Richard Mack actually was caught on camera saying, you know, we put some of our wives and some of our women up on the front lines in order to garner sympathy. Because if the police had taken shots and shot women before they had shot the protesting men, well, then they know that there would have been a revolution on, because nobody's going to tolerate the government shooting and killing innocent women. We'll talk about the gender wars at a later time, but it's true. He's absolutely despicable for doing that, but it's absolutely right that if the federal government had attacked women, these sympathetic women at the Bundy protest, the Bundy Ranch, well, then there would have been a revolution before morning. So, again, that's the kind of thing that's true. If you push a negative hard enough, it will push through and become a positive. So a negative thing, for example, the feds attacking, you know, a Tea Party, can become a positive. Rule number 11. Now, this is one that libertarians really need to recognize, because it's probably the biggest problem that I see. The price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. Never let the enemy score points because you're caught without a solution to the problem. So this is an example, you know, don't kick down somebody's sandcastle unless you have something better to put it in its place. Because how many times have you been in a debate as a libertarian with someone and they're like, okay, fine, what's your solution to the problem? And somebody will be like, oh, well, libertarians, I saw this just the other day on my buddy, I think Jeff Scully's thread, where he was posting something on Facebook. He was tearing down the government about, for whatever reason. And somebody goes, well, why don't you guys, all I hear libertarians do is say, oh, you guys are terrible and the government's bad. Well, what is your solution to the problems? Why don't you propose something constructive? And you know what? If you win a debate and everybody's like, oh, wow, absolutely. Or let's say you win the public office or whatever your battle is, you win it. People are going to expect you to have some answers because they nominated you, they elected you, you were the person who won the fight. People are going to look at you as the leader now. They're going to say, hey, so what's your solution? And if you don't have one, you're going to get knocked off your perch pretty darn quick. So again, remember, the price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. Dang, I got a bunch of Art of War, Sun Tzu to get through, and I'll get through those pretty quick. I'll blaze through these. Number 12, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. Oh man, this is so true. Cut off the support network and isolate the target from sympathy. Go after people and not institutions. People hurt faster than institutions. This is cruel, but very effective. Direct, personalized criticism and ridicule works. Absolutely, ladies and gentlemen. Again, going after Mother Jones as a newspaper outlet is not going to do much. But David Korn, for example, if you go after David Korn, that's different. That's what the left does all the time. They're always making personal attacks. They're not going after the Heritage. You're not seeing headlines where they're attacking the Heritage Institute and stuff like that. Maybe in like the intelligentsia and like left-wing academics and some of the other think tanks maybe attacking Heritage or whatever, blah, blah. No, they're attacking people. They're attacking the ideas of the people. They're attacking Ted Cruz. They're attacking Rand Paul because people hurt faster than institutions. They're attacking Charles and David Koch. You know, they don't attack Koch Industries. They don't attack, you know, the different institutions that the Kochs run, the Mercatus Center, because nobody cares. So they're like, oh, Mercatus Center does this, Mercatus Center does that. Who cares? Who even knows what IHS is out there in the American public? Most people have no clue what the Institute for Humane Studies does or is or who it's funded by. Or FreedomWorks, right? They don't go after FreedomWorks. They go after Matt Kibbe. You know, they go after Adam Brandon. They go after the people because that is how you have a successful strategy. All right, so let's get to Sun Tzu. I just wrote down a few of his Art of War precepts that I think you all need to realize, but you all need to go and read these again, ladies and gentlemen. Very important, the Art of War. Let's go to number 18. Which I think is an important one. All warfare is based on deception. Absolutely true. Remember when I told you the story about the NYPD officer who had the secret kick? Well, his strategy was based on deception. He would always deceive by doing a misplaced kick, but then he would turn around and kick you in the head. So remember, if you're fighting a fight, know that your enemy is almost always lying. Number 19. When you're able to attack, you have to seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near. That is very important. You know, Robert E. Lee actually used these kinds of tactics, him and Stonewall Jackson, in the Civil War. When Stonewall Jackson was going up and down the Shenandoah, he was always moving his cannons to make it seem as if he had more cannons than he actually had. So the Union forces were always confused into thinking that his cannons were really close when they were far away, and they always thought that he had more cannons than he actually did because he would fire and then he would move. He would fire and then he would move so that they always thought that there were more cannons than he actually were. All right, number 20. Hold out baits to entice the enemy. Feign disorder and crush him. Very important. Holding out bait, you know, this is the kind of strategy where, for example, you want to make, like, look as if you have a weakness somewhere. Like, so, for example, in martial arts, leave something out for someone to attack, and then once they move towards it, boom, sucker punch. Number 21, if he is secure at all points, be prepared for him. If he is superior in strength, evade him. Very important. Do not fight a larger opponent, ladies and gentlemen, because it is usually a bad idea. Picking your battles is the key to winning. Remember, Fabian strategy. Fight a war of attrition. Fight the fights that you know you can win. If the enemy is larger and more well-equipped, you want to fight the battles that you can fight and not take a bigger enemy head-on. That's just it's just suicide bordering on murder. And a good example, a historical example of this would have been the Battle of Gettysburg, Pickett's charge. So Colonel Pickett crossed an open field, lost like 9/10 of his men, like, you know, 2/3 or more, over 2/3 of his men, thousands and thousands of men died because he did this useless charge against, I believe it was Little Round Top. And he just got destroyed because he had an enemy that was superior in strength and he took him head on. They took them head on and he got just absolutely destroyed. Number 22, If your opponent is of choleric temper, seek to irritate him. Pretend to be weak, that he may grow arrogant. And there's two things there. So if he has a bad temper, irritate him. Use ridicule, like Saul Alinsky talked about. And if he is arrogant, then you want to pretend to be weak. Oh my, I just don't know what I'll do. Oh my goodness, I'm not strong. And then you lure your opponent in with that weakness because he grows arrogant. And then bam, sucker punch. Yeah, judo chop. All right, so we're almost there. Number 23. Oh, excuse me, number 25. These military devices leading to victory must not be divulged beforehand. Oh my God. I can't even tell you how many examples I can think of. The best one I can think of is all the Ron Paul delegates talking about their delegate strategy on the dailypaul.com before the 2008 and 2012 elections. All the libertarians, what did they do? They all posted exactly what they're going to do. We're going to take over the caucuses. We're going to take over this. We're going to take over that. Well, then they were ready for you. So they changed the rules beforehand. So they know your strategy because you're projecting it online. You know what? And I don't really know a good way to change this, because I think the problem with libertarians, and I'll call some of these people paltards, and I do it lovingly because I was happily a paltard, because the problem with these people is that they just cannot keep their freaking mouth shut, and that's why it's so important to have libertarian special forces, because the special forces understand what it is we're fighting against. And if you are a freedom fighter, a serious freedom fighter, then you will know you do not project your strategy beforehand. Even if you're doing a call to action, for example, and you're trying to rally people to go to a caucus, don't post it online that you're trying to get people. Call them on the phone. Get the phone numbers beforehand, right? Do not let the opponents know what you're trying to do. If your strategy is to take over the Republican Party, why would you announce that you're trying to do that? Because all they're going to do is bolster their forces and be prepared for you. Do not be a paltard and tell people on the Daily Poll that you're planning on taking over the caucus the next day and you're calling for people, right? Real libertarians, real freedom fighters, people who actually care about these ideas getting implemented are not going to post things online. If you're an idiot, you will post things online. And if you're an idiot, why are you listening to my podcast? This show is not for you. Go be a weak little wussy somewhere else, okay? Again, we're talking about the art of warfare here. This is not for any little weaklings. Okay, Sun Tzu. All right, this is in Waging War. I've only got two more to go. And then we'll talk a little bit about chess versus checkers in strategy, and then we'll be all done. Number six. There is no instance of a country having benefited from prolonged warfare. And this is Sun Tzu, and I found this interesting because it's absolutely true. This is a libertarian precept here. There's no instance of a country having benefited from prolonged warfare. Sometimes war is actually necessary. And that when it comes time to defend yourself, World War II, for example, when we were attacked by the Japanese, or when, you know, any other instance, when it comes time, when you have been attacked, you do need to fight sometimes. You have to know how to fight. But here's the thing. Fighting over long periods of time, even if it's a defensive war, it's bad for you. It's going to drain your resources. I'll use the example, the video game example, Civilization, earlier. You know, I noticed yesterday when I was playing the game that the longer that I spent having to defend myself from all of these foreign invasions, the more I was spending time building archers and building catapults and building all of these tools of war, the less time and resources that I could use building things like temples and churches and cultural things like libraries and important cultural artifacts that society needs in order to have a strong civilization. So again, war is not good for anyone. It's not good for the attacker, and it's not good for the defender, because the time and energy and resources that you could be using in other things is spent fighting. So I think that's interesting that Sun Tzu said that. And number 18, excuse me, well, I guess he says, that's it. The lengthy campaigns are not a good way to fight again, you want to get a fight over with as soon as possible so that you can go back to doing more constructive things. I think that's probably a good way to end the podcast. What do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Did you learn something today? Did you find this interesting? If so, I'll do more shows like this. Send me an email. Tell me what you thought of the show. And if you have your own tactics or strategy or something that you think is interesting, leave a comment at thelibertarianrepublic.com on this post, Liberty and the Art of War. I think this is something that libertarians really need to talk about more. So often we talk about like the blunderous wars of the past, and we don't talk about ways to avoid war by using the strategies, the tactics of war. I think more libertarians need to take martial arts. They need to study self-defense. They need to study the art of war. They need to learn the tactics and rules for radicals. The tactics that the socialists are using have been effective. And this war, we didn't ask for this war, ladies and gentlemen, but we do need to end it, and we need to win it, and we need to win it fast, because a prolonged war is not good for any of us. I hope that Liberty wins this side. What do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Send us an email, and don't forget to check out our sister site, libertyviral.com. That's our little BuzzFeed-style listicle site. It's a fun site. It's also a site where you get viral content. I just want to say thank you very much for listening to this show. If you really like our podcast, do us a favor. Subscribe to us on iTunes, or you can get us on Stitcher if you have an Android. And if you really love us, do me a favor. Go to iTunes and give me a good review, ladies and gentlemen. That is all I'm asking. I'm not asking you to send any money, although that would be nice, but clicking on an ad would be just as good, and coming back every single day is what I really want to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.